I'm delighted now to welcome Steve Jimenez. He is an award-winning journalist, writer, and producer. His new book is called The Book of Matt, Hidden Truths About the Murder of Matthew Shepard. Actually, it came out last year, but the paperback just came out last month. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Good morning.
Good morning. Now, it seems that the very well-known murder of the young gay man, Matthew Shepard, in 1998 was not a hate crime after all. Rather, it was a murder that involved methamphetamine, and that Matthew and his murderer, Aaron McKinney, knew each other pretty well, that McKinney was bisexual. Basically, there's so much about the story that we've heard in the media and through the theater, through the Laramie Project, that simply isn't true. How did you start investigating this story?
Well, Mary Charlotte, first of all, let me say that when I went to Laramie originally, which was back in early 2000, I went there to write the story as we all perceived it at the time, which was the story of the hate crime. And I was going there to write a made-for-television movie script. And I went there really to research the case, but I arrived there believing the story as everyone else did. And the first person that I met and interviewed was the prosecutor in the case, Cal Ruruka. And I asked him to help educate me about the case. I was going through the voluminous public record that was there in the courthouse. One of the things that many people don't realize that I should mention is that the record, the court record, was under seal for 1 year from the time, a few days after the crime occurred, until Aaron McKinney, the principal perpetrator in the case, was convicted and sentenced to two life terms. So during that year, while the media was in Laramie, they never had a chance to really look at the actual record in the case. And for the most part, they could not interview witnesses, trial witnesses, or other principals in the case because they were bound by a gag order. So when I arrived in Laramie, I was really interested in looking at the public record, but had no idea what I would start to find there. And it was really through that initial education with the prosecutor and beginning to talk with other people in Laramie that I began to realize that there was more to this story than what had come out at the time.
Which everybody in Laramie knew, but this other narrative, this other parallel narrative, which really wasn't true, was the dominant narrative. And a lot of people seem to be pretty interested in setting the record straight.
Yes. Well, I will say that most people in Laramie did not believe that it was a hate crime. And I heard that at the beginning, but at first I thought, well, maybe this is because they're from the area or they're upset about how the reputation of the town has been damaged. But it was something from the very beginning I heard from a number of people that this is not as the media reported it. But surely, as I went on doing the research, more and more people told me there was more to this crime. So, you know, as a journalist, that really interested me. It aroused my curiosity. By that point, I had decided to put the screenplay aside and to really focus on the story as a journalist and to look at it that way, which was really to continue researching it and interviewing people. I interviewed well over 100 people for the book and, you know, and learned a lot of things that I didn't know before.
Well, one thing is that the phenomenon of crystal methamphetamine, which we now know because there's been a lot of publicity about it and there's been the TV show Breaking Bad. But back in 1998, I don't think very many people really knew, unless they were on the inside, that it played a significant role in Wyoming, in the gay community, in the whole set of phenomena around crimes that were happening there and still are.
Yes. And just to say, when I learned about the crystal meth side of the story, that was something that really prompted me to continue to dig deeper. And if I could just, you know, give a little bit of background about that. As a gay man, and I consider myself a survivor of the AIDS era, I was living in New York at the peak of the AIDS period and lost many, many friends. And as I began to do, you know, early research into crystal meth, when I realized that there were higher rates of HIV transmission among people using crystal meth, part of the reason is when you're on this drug, you feel all powerful, you feel like nothing can hurt you, and, you know, it's well known that people on crystal meth frequently will not, you know, use any protection. And so it was, there was, you know, it was helping to spread the virus. And that really, really concerned me. To go to your point, though, in 1998, the meth epidemic had already hit Wyoming, and it was already a serious problem there. It was already becoming a problem in certain urban gay enclaves, initially, especially New York, Los Angeles, San Francisco. But it was already a problem in 1998 in Denver, where Matthew Shepard lived before he moved to Laramie. So the thing is that the national media, the mainstream media, did not really pick up on the meth story until the early to mid-2000s. I can remember because in 2002, I was working on a story for the New York Times Magazine, and in 2004, I did an ABC News story, 2020 story, and at that time, meth was really not being talked about very much. It began to really hit, you know, seriously 2005, 2006, but again, we're talking about 7 to 8 years after Matthew Shepard was killed. Initially in Wyoming, it was kind of considered a dirty secret. People didn't really want to talk about it. There was shame connected to it. In those early days, the approach of law enforcement was, you know, just anyone that's involved with that drug, let's just lock them up. Now the approach is much more treatment-oriented in the gay community initially because it kind of came on the heels of the AIDS epidemic. People in the gay community initially didn't want to talk about crystal meth, but it became a very, very serious problem. I remember noticing the change when suddenly you would see in places like the Castro in San Francisco or in the Chelsea neighborhood in New York, you'd start to see posters at bus stops and in the neighborhood, you know, warning about crystal meth. At the same time, you started to see signs, big billboards as you drove into Laramie or as you drove across Wyoming talking about crystal meth. But at the time Matthew was killed, that wasn't the case.
Let's talk about Matthew Shepard. I mean, you make the case very clearly and convincingly about how his life unfolded to the point where he was a drug user, a drug dealer. He was involved in a kind of, I mean, who knew that Laramie, Wyoming had an underworld, but there we have it, and a kind of underworld full of hustlers and drug dealers and all kinds of things. He was troubled. He was sexually abused. There was one incident where, as a teenager, he abused others. He was also a very sweet and charismatic person. And part of the book is very poignant because it's about your getting to know a person whom you had never met and getting to know him quite intimately. Tell us a little bit about how his life unfolded and how he got to that point.
Yes. Well, one of the things that really interested me when I was doing early research on this story is as I began to go through, you know, reams of news reports, printed, you know, television reports, and just, you know, the huge public record on this murder, what I noticed was there was a conspicuous absence of Matthew Shepard. Matthew Shepard was not there, or if he was there, it was the same set of descriptions repeated over and over again. You know, he was well-educated and well-traveled. He liked to talk about politics. He was interested in human rights. He spoke three languages. But it was the same set of facts repeated over and over. And so, as a writer, I kept thinking, who was this young man? And so, it was really you know, getting to meet a number of Matthew's friends, you know, people that knew him from the University of Wyoming, people that he knew in Denver before he moved to Laramie, some of his boyfriends, and began to get a sense of who this person was. And he was very much as you described him. He was a complex, very sensitive young man, and also someone who had been troubled. And he'd been troubled since he was a very young, you know, since he was really a boy, as you mentioned. You know, he had been sexually abused. I think those wounds were very much still with him and I think played into his use of drugs to medicate and perhaps on some level even anesthetize, you know, those painful experiences. But, you know, many of the people who even talked about the drug use would always just say how fond of Matthew they were. I remember what one dealer who had been involved with Matthew in Denver and then continued when Matthew moved to Laramie. And he said, you know, we all thought Matt was going places that the rest of us never would, because of his education, his exposure. But, you know, I felt while writing the book that my affection for this person that I never met grew, that what he suffered, the experiences that he went through, I felt a lot of empathy for what he had gone through. And, of course, realizing that there are a lot of young people today, there were young people then, a lot of young people, gay, straight, whatever, going through similar problems. And I think one of the reasons that he got swept up in the drug world is that it gave him a place to belong.
Describe a little bit this underworld that Matthew was involved with. There's a character whom you met and talked to extensively named Doc O'Connor, who was, it's very weird, I have to just say as an aside, to have seen the Laramie Project, that play that called itself Documentary Theater, and then the Laramie Project 10 years later, and some of the characters whom you describe in the book are portrayed in that, and it's like, it's different.
They're almost
people.
Not the same. Right, they're not the same
people. Doc O'Connor is one of those who seemed sort of amiable in the play, but in real life, he was kind of like
a tough character.
A tough character, to say the least.
An outlaw. Yeah. Well, Doc, I've gotten to know Doc very well over the years. And, the Laramie Project presents, it's not a multidimensional portrait of Doc. Let me put it that way. The Doc that is portrayed in the Laramie Project is a man who has seen, the scene I remember with Matthew is they're driving in the limousine, and it's a very almost sentimental scene talking about the twinkling stars in the sky, which I think could be part of the real Matthew, but there are other sides that are completely missing. And, in the book, I talk about Doc's history, a very, illustrious history before, he moved to Wyoming and Denver. He sold antiques. He was involved with, adult bookshops. There's something that I describe in the new afterword I wrote for the paperback, where a woman came forward whose husband knew Doc in Denver before he ever moved to Wyoming, and he had a bar there, and she's just talking about, the prostitutes and the girls and the whole routine Doc had going. So, yes, Doc is truly a character, and the real person is very different than the person portrayed in the Laramie Project.
Now, Aaron McKinney and Russell Henderson, who were both given life sentences in prison without parole for the murder of Matthew Shepard, are in fact two very different people whose involvement in this crime was very different. Aaron McKinney was deeply involved with Doc O'Connor.
Yes. Well, Aaron had known Doc since he was a teenager. And Doc is a figure he likes to, offer to help, guys that are in trouble, young guys that are in trouble. In the time I was working on the book, there were several that he had living in Bosler, in this town 18 miles north of Laramie, where he lives. But Aaron McKinney specifically, and I'll give you a little background, Aaron McKinney's mom died from a botched surgery, a hysterectomy, and Aaron received a settlement of $100,000. And this is in the years preceding the murder. Aaron, he went through the money very, very quickly, kind of buying cars, drugs, jewelry, giving his friends loans, buying them gifts. But one of the things Aaron liked to do was to hire Doc's limousine and to party in it. And, he was very kind of looked up to some of his gangster rap. They were heroes to him. And, he sort of fancied himself one of them, spending money, doing drugs, partying a lot. But yes, Aaron McKinney knew Doc for several years before this happened. And partied in the limo. And as it turns out, Matt Shepard, when he moved to Laramie, also began partying in Doc O'Connor's limos and using them for a variety of things.
Well, Aaron, as some people whom you write about put it, was essentially owned by Doc on some level. He was bisexual, he was a hustler, and Doc pimped him out.
Yeah, I write in the book, what I do, Mary Charlotte, is I let other people in the book tell their stories with Doc, and there are several who talk about, in fact, yes, that Doc pimped Aaron McKinney out. I've been a little careful in saying that myself, but there are certainly a number of named sources who have been there and have witnessed the way Doc has treated Aaron, has witnessed exchanges of money, and that's certainly true.
And so this whole idea that, first of all, Aaron McKinney and Matthew Shepard knew each other. Not
yes.
only did they know each other, they probably knew each other in the biblical sense, in the back of the limousine. And there was not, I mean, the idea that this was a hate crime because Aaron was homophobic. I mean, the whole picture you paint of Laramie, not that I had a lot of preconceptions about Laramie, Wyoming, but it's a lot less homophobic and a lot more shady underworld than
yes.
I ever would have thought.
Well, this is the thing about methamphetamine and meth culture, is that it's not just Laramie. I mean, this was towns, communities across Wyoming, but across large pieces of the West and the Midwest. I mean, you could go and find problems, meth-related problems in Nebraska, in Kansas, in Missouri, in Montana, in Colorado. And now, sadly, it has spread to many other parts of the country. But there certainly was a meth underworld in Wyoming, and at the time this was going on, it was already thriving. I interviewed for the book a number of dealers. Some of them served serious prison time. One dealer was one of the first people to bring meth to Laramie in 1993, 5 years before Matthew's killing. He brought it from Arizona, and he was a bartender in Laramie, knew Matthew Shepard, knew Aaron, knew the rest of the people, or a number of the people in the story. But, by 1998, it was already a serious problem there. And in the subsequent years, if you looked at a roster of the people that were incarcerated in the county jail, you could have up to 70% of them were there for meth-related crimes. And this was true across the state, but as I said, in many other states as well. And the meth problem just continued to grow. I'll mention something interesting. I've been working on an op-ed piece, and so I've been doing research, contacting some of the leading meth experts in the country, asking them for kind of the latest information. And I learned about a study that the University of Texas at Austin, the School of Social Work, published in June of this year. And it's showing that meth is really on the rise again, because after several years ago, one of the precursor ingredients became banned. You couldn't sell large quantities of pseudoephedrine. So what's happened is other precursor ingredients have been created. So, for example, now there's a liquid form of methamphetamine that's being smuggled across the border, and then it's being converted into what they call ice once it's in Texas. So some of the people that are on the front lines of this are talking about a newly emerging crystal meth crisis, and the rates in Texas, for example, are going up, not down.
We're talking to Steve Jimenez about his book, The Book of Matt, Hidden Truths About the Murder of Matthew Shepard. Let's talk for a moment about Russell Henderson, the other young man who was put in jail, two life sentences without chance of parole, for the murder of Matthew Shepard. And we'll talk about what actually happened that night in a moment. But who was Russell Henderson?
Yeah, and you're hitting on a really important point. When I first went to Laramie, based on what I knew from news reports, the news reports had the involvement of McKinney and Henderson. Pretty much it was reported that their involvement was identical. Both Aaron McKinney and Russell Henderson beat Matthew Shepard to death. And I wasn't prepared to really be surprised by what I found. But what I discovered with Russell Henderson is he was a young man who had no real criminal record. I mean, I think he had maybe, some kind of driving infraction, but no history at all of any felonies or any kind of violent behavior. Here's a guy who, as a teenager, I think he was 15 years old, was given an Eagle Scout badge by the governor of Wyoming, and it was on, you know, the front page of the local papers. Someone who, as I started to interview people, was very, very well-liked. People were stunned that Russell could have been involved with something like this. And, you know, it's no secret that I have, I continue to visit Russell. I see him at least two or three times a year. I go to Wyoming to see him in prison. I feel that the media coverage of this case and the inaccuracies and the distortions and, in some cases, the lies certainly had an impact on how this case was handled in the courtroom. And I think it's a travesty, really, that Russell Henderson and Aaron McKinney both got the same sentence. Aaron McKinney took the barrel of a .357 Magnum and smashed it into Matthew Shepard's skull repeatedly. That's what caused Matthew's death. Russell Henderson's involvement, there is no evidence whatsoever that Russell Henderson ever hit Matthew, touched him. He was involved as an accomplice in what he thought was going to be a robbery, but he was unaware of Aaron McKinney's previous relationship with Matthew Shepard and what was involved. Russell Henderson was not dealing methamphetamine. Aaron McKinney was. They had only been friends for a few months.
They worked together.
Aaron McKinney had gotten out of jail on a burglary offense that he had committed in December of 1997. And someone introduced him to Russell Henderson. He was looking for a job when he got out of jail. And Russell offered to talk to his boss, and he got a job working for the same roofing company. And this was early in the summer of 1998. So they were really friends for only a few months at the time this crime happened. In fact, Aaron McKinney and Matthew Shepard had been friends longer than Aaron McKinney and Russell Henderson.
So what actually happened on that fateful night, October 6th, 1998, that resulted in Matthew Shepard being beaten and left to die on a fence in Wyoming?
Yeah. Well, this is what I discovered, Mary Charlotte, is that the group that Matthew had been involved with, friends that he had met in Denver, they handled regular shipments of methamphetamine that came from Denver to Laramie. The typical routine was there were 12 ounces. 6 ounces of meth were dropped in Fort Collins, and 6 came on to Laramie. And Matthew Shepard, on the night of the crime, okay, Matthew Shepard was supposed to do a run with another person from that group. But because there was competition in Laramie, Matthew and Aaron were actually selling and distributing drugs at the same bars in Laramie, at the Fireside Bar, at the Ranger, at the Library Bar. And this is, again, very well documented by sources, is that Matthew had gotten pulled off this run at the last minute. He was kind of being pressured. People felt that he was moving up too fast, okay, and that he was, you know, a competitive threat to them. Aaron McKinney, okay, was unaware that Matthew had been pulled off that run. And if you follow the sequence of events that evening, Aaron was literally on Matthew's tail, going to the same bars that Matthew had been at. And what Aaron McKinney was looking for was the 6 ounces of methamphetamine, which he believed Matthew was going to have in his possession.
As you said before, Aaron McKinney had blown through a large amount of money, and he was living hand-to-mouth and was always basically in debt to other people.
He owed his suppliers money. I know, you know, a couple of his key suppliers, who they were. He not only owed them money, this was October 6th. He hadn't paid his rent for October. He had a live-in girlfriend in an apartment in Laramie, and he also had a four-month-old child that he was, you know, to support. But probably the most significant thing, Mary Charlotte, is that Aaron McKinney had been up on meth for a week. And in the book, I trace the sequence of events of the people he was using meth with. A few days before the crime, he had also gotten his hands on a lot of cocaine and was blowing through all these drugs. And I've interviewed a number of people who were using drugs with him in the days leading up to the crime. And he was, you know, bent out of shape and very, very wired. And when he took Matthew Shepard, he was really after the six ounces of meth. And when Matthew Shepard did not have the 6 ounces of meth and had a very small amount of money on him, Aaron McKinney completely flipped out in a classic meth-fueled rage.
So this meth-fueled rage, which you have talked to Aaron McKinney himself about, is a kind of experience where you don't even really know what you're doing, and it's as if you're looking at somebody else.
That's right.
Doing these horrible things.
That's right. And this is classic because as part of my research, I looked at, you know, a number of other cases. There's a man at UCLA Medical Center, Rick Rawson, whose his specialty is the relationship between meth and violence. And he really taught me about what meth psychosis is and what it does. The hallucinations, the paranoia that comes on. You know, this is part of long-term meth use. And Aaron McKinney had experienced bouts of that, you know, before this the attack on Matthew Shepard. But one thing that I think is important to mention is that in a 24-hour period, Aaron McKinney assaulted four males. One of those four males was Matthew Shepard, and obviously it was the worst of the assaults. But the night before this crime happened, Aaron McKinney broke into his cousin's apartment in Laramie looking for one of his friends, someone he claimed owed him money for meth. And he got into the house, and there were a couple of other guys staying there, and he lunged at this fellow and attacked him, and the other guys pulled Aaron off. During the actual the beating of Matthew Shepard, Russell Henderson tried to stop the beating. Aaron McKinney took what was the murder weapon, the .357 Magnum, and struck Russell Henderson across the face. That night, Russell Henderson got 9 stitches at the emergency room, and you can still see the scar on his face today. After leaving Matthew tied to the fence, literally minutes later, Russell Henderson and Aaron McKinney pulled the truck up in a residential neighborhood in Laramie, and they got into a fight with two young Hispanic kids. Aaron McKinney ran to the truck, got the gun again, and struck one of these guys across the head. He had a huge wound across, you know, and across the whole top surface of his head, a huge gash. So you have here four men, Russell Henderson, the young Hispanic man, and the man that Aaron claimed owed him money, and then Matthew Shepard. How do you separate out the motives and say Aaron was motivated by anti-gay hate when he fatally beat Matthew Shepard, but he assaulted the other three men? What was driving him then?
So what you're saying is that it was the robbery motive, trying to get money and drugs from Matthew Shepard, and the meth-fueled rage, which
reeled out of control.
It has no reason at all.
Yeah, and in the book, I have first-hand descriptions of McKinney talking as they were even driving down the street after they left Matthew Shepard. You know, everything was moving, you know, and these are classic descriptions. When you talk with people that have used a lot of meth in terms of the hallucinations, this is common behavior for people that use a lot of meth.
So how did the story of the hate crime come about?
Well, it's fascinating. There were two friends of Matthew Shepard, Walt Bolden and Alex Trout. And Matthew's father, Dennis Shepard, after receiving word that Matthew had been severely beaten, contacted Walt Bolden because it was going to take the Shepherds, Dennis and Judy Shepard, quite a bit of time to get back to the States from Saudi Arabia. Walt Bolden and Alex Trout went to the hospital in Fort Collins where Matthew had been taken from Laramie. And they got on the phone and they started calling gay organizations in Wyoming and Colorado saying that, you know, that there was an anti-gay attack, that Matthew had been beaten because he was gay. They also called a friend of Matthew that worked at the Casper Star Tribune. And it got picked up very quickly by Associated Press. And literally, overnight, the story spread that Matthew had been attacked because he was gay. But meantime, the police had not even really even in any way launched a real investigation into what had happened, but it took off. And I remember the prosecutor, Cal Ruka, telling me a story. Soon after he got word of the crime, he couldn't sleep one evening, and this is really very early on, in the first couple of days after the crime. He was watching television, and, you know, he watched it was one of the first press conferences held by the sheriff's department in Laramie. And the reporters were rushing to conclusions and would say something like, you know, well, he was hanging on the fence. I mean, isn't that a crucifixion? And pressing, and, you know, I mean, the police in Laramie were not used to having the national media on their doorstep, and maybe the sheriff would say, well, I guess you could say that. And
but suddenly, he wasn't hanging on the fence.
He wasn't hanging on the fence, although if you ask people even today, they will say, isn't that the young gay boy who was hanging on the fence? Vanity Fair published a story called The Crucifixion of Matthew Shepard. In fact, Matthew was not hanging on the fence. He was sitting down on the ground, and his hands were tied behind his back by rope to a fence post. But he was never hanging on the fence, yet I can remember seeing, I remember an illustration that was in the Philadelphia Inquirer showing a young man hanging on the fence like Jesus.
How did the police and the prosecutors miss the drug story? I mean, eventually there was a prosecution and two convictions.
That's right. Well, first of all, I will say, I can't speak for all the police, but I can tell you that as far as the prosecutor knows, has always known, that methamphetamine was a factor in the case. What he prosecuted was a case for felony murder and related offenses, including saying that Matthew had been kidnapped. But this was never prosecuted as a hate crime. Wyoming didn't have a hate crime statute, and the prosecutor has stated that he doesn't believe that there was evidence for a hate crime. He's a state and federal prosecutor, and he never believed that the evidence was there. And just to say, because people think somehow this is a political matter, this was a prosecutor who was an elected Democrat. He was elected for four consecutive terms of 4 years each. So he was the prosecutor in Laramie, in Albany County, for 16 years. And he has said meth was always a part of the case. The thing is, he never gave any media interviews at all while the case was going on because he was afraid of a mistrial. I do have in the book, police officers who are on the record talking about the fact that this was a drug crime. One of them, Ben Fritzen, was one of the lead homicide detectives in the case. He took Aaron McKinney's confession. He had investigated Aaron McKinney previously on meth offenses. He had investigated Aaron and his whole cohort, his whole group of cohorts that were involved in selling meth. So in terms of the police knowing this about Aaron McKinney, of course they knew.
So basically you have a situation where law enforcement and the judicial system knows one set of stories and the public knows a whole different set of stories. And these things are happening parallel to each other.
That's true. And Mary Charlotte, we have to think about how this, what we've learned about the Matthew Shepard case, this is not isolated. We're dealing with this kind of thing in media every day here in this country. Think about, the story foisted on the American people about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. This happens all the time. And so one of the reasons I stuck with the story as long as I did is I thought this is an important case study for us to understand how a national myth can begin with two people starting to make phone calls, and the next thing you know, the president is on board with it, and, our representatives in Congress, and it becomes something other than what it really was.
We're talking to Steve Jimenez about his book, The Book of Matt, Hidden Truths About the Murder of Matthew Shepard. Now, your process of getting to know people along the way was really interesting, and you talk about it very honestly in the book, and it took a long time, as relationship building does, and there were some really scary moments along the way, dangerous moments for you.
Yes. People often ask me about this, and you never bite off all of it at one time. I started, and as I mentioned earlier, you hear about rumors in town. I remember one of the early ones that I heard from someone that had worked in the prosecutor's office. And he said, the homicide had nothing to do with Shepard's sexual preference. And, I was flabbergasted. But he also said, you cannot use my name. He was afraid about the health and safety of his wife and kids. But as I, went on, I developed a number of sources that were willing to talk to other people and say, this guy is for real. He's really doing his homework. Would you talk with him? So it was often one source would lead me to another, But I think from the very beginning, earning the cooperation of the prosecutor was very important because there were people in law enforcement then that would trust me sufficiently to give me an interview. But there were some very, when I realized that Matthew had gotten in over his head, you know, in the drug business, it was scary to interview some of those people. In the years since, some have served prison time. You know, some of the people Matthew were involved in were, you know, never got caught. I mean, it was a variety of things, as well as with Aaron McKinney. One of the dealers Aaron McKinney had been involved with ended up getting caught and convicted several years later, and he's now away in prison with a very, very long sentence.
Did you have to leave anything out of the book in order to protect your safety after publication?
You know, there were a few things that I left out of the book. One of the things that people have used, who have been, you know, that people that have been critical say that there are some unnamed or anonymous sources in the book. There are 112 named sources in the book, but there are in a few cases where I used pseudonyms, and there are people that would only agree to talk with me if I didn't use their actual name, particularly if they were involved with any kind of illegal activities. They were fearful of, you know, the consequences or retaliation. But that's also true of people in law enforcement. Some of my law enforcement sources are still working in Wyoming today in law enforcement. And so this was risky on their part to talk to me for a book. So, you know, I had to use some pseudonyms in cases just because of the danger that was involved.
Right, which is standard.
Yes, yes. But it's something that, you know, the fact that I was digging into this and looking into some of the real circumstances around the murder, I think it made people uncomfortable. And that's not just some people, you know, on the wrong side of the law, but also even some people in law enforcement.
What did they think would happen to them? I mean, why were the people in law enforcement afraid to talk to you?
Well, you know, I'm going to answer that indirectly. I remember meeting with one of the heads of the DCI in Wyoming. It's the Division of Criminal Investigation. And the person, while I was interviewing him, just said to me, he said, you know, Wyoming, unfortunately, has a history of cops turning bad. And there's certainly, you know, and I think you can find this in many places. You don't have to go to Wyoming for this. But, you know, there are people in law enforcement who are corrupt. And that's that's just a reality.
So what has been the reaction of the gay community? Your book has been out for, what, about a year?
Yes.
And at the beginning, there was resistance to this narrative, which was not the young, sweet, angelic, gay martyr Matthew Shepard narrative.
Right. Well, you know, we've noticed a real change over the years since the book came out. At the beginning, there were some people, even who hadn't read the book, you know, that were resistant to the idea of raising questions or bringing in new information. Initially, there were only, you know, two or three gay journalists nationally that would really do interviews with me or even get behind the book. But over the months, that really began to shift. And the shift we noticed was as people read the book. There's a theater critic in Washington, D.C., who's written about the fact that he wouldn't read the book, but people kept saying, you've got to read it. And he wouldn't even buy it. He got it in the library and then ended up really liking the book and has now written about it, you know, the Laramie Project, the play, in light of my book, talking about some of the things you raised earlier. So I think the community has been coming around slowly but surely. I did an event earlier this year in San Francisco that was sponsored by the James Hormel Center for, you know, Gay and Lesbian Center at the San Francisco Public Library, have been sponsored by other gay organizations to do events. But initially, the idea alone, there were some people that wouldn't even have me come to their bookstores because they were afraid it would really alienate the community.
You make a point which I think is very important to talk about and to think about, which is that the tragedy that actually happened is far more nuanced and tragic than the tragic narrative that we learned from the Laramie Project and from the narratives that happened initially. And one of the reasons, there's many reasons for that, and I would love you to talk about it, but one of the reasons is that the gay community has been so vulnerable to methamphetamine.
Yes, and, you know, luckily, because of education efforts and the community has really, you know, stood up, crystal meth, you know, there's really been some improvement in the use of crystal meth and meth addiction in the gay community, but it has been a serious problem. And, you know, I think it's important to deal with it. My feeling about, you know, the complexities you mention is that it doesn't help us as a community to attempt to shape and control, to spin the narrative about who we are. You know, we deserve to be as human as anyone else and to have our lives understood in that way. And to me, again, if we're serious about, you know, dealing with the kinds of issues that led to Matthew Shepard's tragedy, then it behooves us to really look at what was behind it. And in this case, the factors were complex. And, you know, what concerns me, you know, are the generations coming after Matthew. And if it's not crystal meth, it could be something else. And I just think the complexities are very, very important.
I think the book speaks to something outside the purview of the book, and that is what happens when you have a country where there are so many troubled people and where there's so much economic inequality. I mean, it's a petri dish for drugs.
Absolutely. And if you trace the evolution of this epidemic and you see the towns that were hit earliest and hardest, they were economically depressed towns. There's a wonderful book called Methland, which deals a lot with Iowa, but you see the towns where meth took hold, and that this became a livelihood for people. The drug, when people were feeling so depressed, made them feel like they had some power. And it moved through those parts of the country. It coincides, the worst, you know, when the epidemic was really hitting, with where the country was economically in 2006, 2007, 2008. And it just moved through that whole part of the country. And certainly economics played a huge role. I mean, people have always said that meth was kind of the poor man's drug.
Now, you presented this book all over the country, including in Laramie, where you had a very, very open reception.
I did. And even though I've spent a lot of time in Laramie over the years, I didn't presume to know what was going to happen that evening. It turned out it was a very cold night. It was 10 below zero that evening in February. And nonetheless, over 200 people came out. It was absolutely fascinating. I was interviewed on stage by a journalist who had covered the Shepard case on Wyoming radio. I had the former editor of the Laramie Boomerang, who was on stage asking me questions, and it was filmed for C-SPAN, Book TV. And it was an event that lasted over 2 hours, and we had a you know, pretty long Q&A. And people from the town got up at the microphones, and not a single person in that audience got up and disputed the findings of my book. On the contrary, they were thanking me for coming. And, you know, they thanked me for coming. So it was really fascinating to bring the story home to Laramie. It was certainly by far the most significant event for me, having written the book, because to actually present the book in a place where people lived the story, and there were a number of people in the audience that I had known, but there were also people that I didn't know. For example, the man who owned the property where the fence was, I had no idea he was there. I'd never met him before. He came up and introduced himself. There were quite a number of people there, and it was satisfying to know that after working on a story for so many years, that there were people in the community that were pleased with what I had done and were supporting it and were happy that the truth was finally coming out.
Yeah, I think this book is yet another example of the importance of investigative journalism, which takes a long time.
It does, and sadly, you know, investigative journalism has really been declining for some time here in the United States. You know, television networks, television shows, you know, are supporting this kind of work less and less. We've seen the cutbacks at newspapers, you know, big city newspapers. So it's something that's very difficult, and there were many times along the way where I thought, you know, I'm out of my mind to keep going with this story. But, you know, I'd keep finding out more things and meeting new sources, and I just felt that it was important. There hadn't been a major book on the Matthew Shepard murder case until this book came out. This was really the first major nonfiction work, and it seemed to me, for a case that was this important, that was such a turning point in gay rights in the country, that we really needed a comprehensive examination and look at the case.
Have Matthew Shepard's parents responded to it?
Well, Matthew Shepard's parents did not respond directly. Shortly after the book came out last fall, there was a statement released by the Matthew Shepard Foundation. It was not signed by a particular person, saying that they were not going to respond to rumors or innuendos. But there hasn't been anything since then. So, you know, I can't second guess what they may be thinking. I'm sure for any parent whose child was killed, it's going to be difficult to look at any new material or facts that come out. So certainly there was no intent on my part in writing the book to be hurtful to the Shepherd family. They'd certainly gone through enough. But I do think for a case that became this important to the nation, that it's important for us to understand what it was really about.
Has the Tectonic Theater Company that created the Laramie Project, have they responded?
They have not responded to the book. However, the Laramie Project did an epilogue 10 years after the first version,
part
2. Yeah,
that was performed here in Santa Fe.
It was performed here, and I have to say that it's troubling to me, because I, 10 years ago, reported and produced a one-hour piece on the Shepherd case for ABC News 2020, and in part 2 of the Laramie Project, they kind of laugh at and ridicule the idea that methamphetamine had anything to do with this crime. And that's just, it's ridiculous, and it's also irresponsible. When this drug has done what it's done, not just in this instance, in this tragedy, but what it's done around the country, to ridicule that is ridiculous. I mean, the prosecutor in the case, as recently as, you know, 2-3 weeks ago, said if methamphetamine were not involved in this case, there wouldn't have been a murder.
I think the book tells us so many things, and it's really worth reading just as a narrative. You know, I've spent the last week following along the ride that you took on this whole journey of many years. But as an example of how we can get a story so wrong and believe in it so deeply, it really gives us the opportunity to question other things in our lives that we believe in that deeply, and to really think about it and think about the importance of opening ourselves up to other points of view. That's one takeaway that I had from this book. And the other was the incredible importance of figuring out how to deal with methamphetamine.
Yes, well, the first point you made, Mary Charlotte, was very much parallels my own journey, because for me, the longer I went on with the story, the more I realized the importance of understanding the complexities for exactly the reasons you mentioned, which is we become attached to a certain narrative. I was attached to this narrative. I was attached to the narrative that this was, you know, a pure, clear-cut instance of anti-gay hate. And so it was a narrative I didn't really want to let go of. And I think that that's been some of the resistance, you know, to the book. But I think the methamphetamine part of the story is very important. And I think, you know, it's not just methamphetamine. It's just addiction in its many forms. It could be alcoholism. It could be another drug. It could be cocaine. Addiction exists in many forms. But this is something that's a big problem in this culture. And I feel that this is a study of that, but also, you know, some amazing characters and people I met along the way that were involved in this tragedy.
Steve Jimenez is author of the book, The Book of Matt, Hidden Truths About the Murder of Matthew Shepard. The paperback version just came out. It has a new afterword by the author, and the book is being published all around the world now.
Yeah, it's coming out, or it came out, I should say, in England, Ireland, Australia, Germany, and Japan on September 16th. I'll be doing an event in London at the end of October. And what has really interested me the most in this whole process, I've been having conversations with people all around the country about about many things, about methamphetamine, about what happens when tabloid media gets hold of a story and they make it into something else. So I hope the public conversations will continue. And for any of your listeners, we have a Facebook page. It's facebook.com/bookofmatt. And I invite you to participate in the conversation if you feel like it.
Steve Jimenez, thanks so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure, Mary Charlotte.